We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchuk, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
A lovely, lovely weekend in the cold, rainy, about to get potential snow.
Looking like a normal Seattle.
Yeah. Well,
weekend in December.
Except for the snow part. That's not normal.
Well, that
happens. It happens. Yeah, it does.
And December is the appropriate month for it to happen, I have to say, which is good.
You know, I still am traumatized by the event we planned for April 14th one year that got snowed out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and it's nice that it appears that Seattle and King County are actually going to open some shelters, although not nearly enough. In fact, Real Change, I think, was asking about the fact that it appeared there was only like 200 extra beds available for.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sure. That's more than enough for the,
6,000 people that are out on the street.
Oh, at least. At least. I think that's an undercount.
Yeah.
But yes. And yeah, it's a fine time of year.
We'll be talking about donating blankets,
warm socks, all that good stuff.
Yeah.
Hats. We'll be talking about that a little bit later this afternoon. So.
Okay. All right. Well, let's dive in. Last week, Jav, you talked about Ed Troyer and being on trial.
Yes. Pierce County Sheriff, who was accused of filing a false report for his claim that a newspaper, black newspaper carrier, was threatening to kill him in January of 2021. He was acquitted of all charges this week. What that boils down to is that the jury believed him, or at least had a reasonable doubt about his denial that he ever did that, versus the testimony of both the newspaper carrier himself and the Pierce, the Tacoma City cop who took Troyer's statements at the scene and who testified against him. Juries believe cops. What can I say? They didn't believe
jury of Troyer's peers, remember?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he has been cleared of wrongdoing, at least by the jury, and he will remain in office until his term expires in, I believe, early 2025. Woohoo. Go Pierce County.
All right. Well, I guess we shouldn't have been surprised by that outcome, but
no, I'm not surprised. I'm disappointed, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I was somewhat surprised by another Seattle City Council member saying they are not going to run again.
Dropping like flies.
Yeah, this week Deborah Juarez announced that she will not be running for re-election next year. Next year is when all 7 district city council seats come up for election, and 2 council members have now said that they will not be running for re-election. Lisa Herbold in District 1 and now Deborah Juarez in District 5. Like Herbold, Juarez has served 2 terms on the council, and next year will be her 8th year. She's currently council president and chair of the Governance, Native Communities, and Tribal Governments Committee, and vice chair of Sarah Nelson's Economic Development, Technology, and City Light Committee. Her retirement from the council could make way for a more progressive representative for District 5 in North Seattle, and also a more progressive city council president. Now, I think Teresa Mosqueda would be a natural for that, but then she would probably have to give up the budget committee, and I don't know if she wants to do that. I think she really enjoys the fact that she's can put the hard work into making sure the city council's priorities, or at least quite a bit of her progressive priorities, get funded in the city budget. So it's going to be I think the decision's going to be up to her which one she feels is more important. I think Alex Peterson is almost certainly going to make a bid for the council president's position, but we'll see. Tammy Morales may want it. I don't know.
She'd be a very intriguing council
president. She would be an interesting person to be city council president.
Both Mosqueda and Morales are in their second term, I believe.
Yeah. Andrew Lewis is quite young and still in his first term. So, but he's also quite ambitious, too. So we'll see.
All right. Well, it's going to make for exciting council races coming up. That's for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, next year. But
I agree.
All right. Moving on.
And after the first of the year, I expect to see more people starting to jump into those races.
Yeah. So far, there's a few people listed as running for the city council races next year on the Seattle Ethics and Elections website, but those are folks who have run in the past as very distant candidates. They tend to not have any funding. You know, they're kind of the perennial candidates who, you know, are running for to highlight various issues.
They are the perma candidates that I recognize some names on that list, but nobody that looks viable.
Yes, and we'll see that. I imagine by about March of next year, we'll have quite a few people in the race.
Yep.
Yeah, when does the Chamber of Commerce officially release their slate of candidates?
About May.
Okay.
Around the filing deadline.
Yeah, right around the filing deadline in May, I think.
All right. So the King County Regional Homelessness Authority.
Just saying May sounds so nice and warm right now.
Yeah. Yes, about the King County Regional Homelessness Authority, they released their final 2023 budget. Their finalized 2023 budget and their five-year plan this week. And that includes the funds that have been approved by the King County Council and the City Council during their budget work this year. Excuse me. The King County Regional Homelessness Authority also gave a slide presentation along with the budget. And in that slide presentation, they had some very, very interesting numbers. They estimate that there are now 62,000 people experiencing homelessness in King County. That's a more than 50% increase over last year's estimate of 40,000 people. That's pretty amazing. Among those 62,000 people, the agency estimates that about 23,000 are unsheltered, and that's the top goal that the Regional Homelessness Authority is trying to hit when they say that they want to get everyone into some kind of shelter. They're focusing as their top priority on those 23,000 unsheltered people. Now, another major goal that they have is to restructure the county's response to homelessness to make it more efficient in getting people off the street and in providing the services that folks need to get stabilized and into affordable permanent housing. Of course, the success of the five-year plan is going to depend heavily on the availability of affordable housing in King, Pierce, and Snohomish counties. The RHA estimates that there will be a gap of 18,870 shelter beds and 45,219 permanent affordable housing units in King County over 5 years, if nothing more is done. Okay.
That extra couple hundred cold weather shelter beds is going to be a big difference.
But, you know, there are other programs ramping up to provide affordable housing right now. The Seattle City Council is working to get more affordable housing built more rapidly. And this week they extended for 1 year an ordinance to exempt affordable housing construction projects from the design review process, which is meant to speed up construction and make it less expensive to build. And the city is going to vote on a new housing levy in the coming year, which is currently being hammered out. And some folks say it may be twice the amount of the prior housing levy. Also, the public housing initiative is going to be coming up on the ballot in February, which could set up a new public housing authority in Seattle. So those things are all in the works. In addition, the Jumpstart payroll tax has set aside millions of dollars for the construction of affordable units inside the city limits, and also funds for converting existing buildings to low-income housing. On top of that are funds allocated by the state legislature in the last session to do the same thing statewide. And quite a bit of that money is going to come to King County. In addition, this week, Governor Inslee announced that he will put a $4 billion initiative before the state legislature to issue bonds for the construction of affordable housing. And I'll talk about that a little bit more here in a few minutes. And there are a lot of other programs provided at the city, county, and state level to subsidize rents for low-income folks, assist with first-time home buyers, build generational wealth, and streamline regulations, among other things. All attempts to increase the affordable housing stock and keep people from falling into homelessness. Now, where the Regional Housing Authority fits into all of this is at the crisis response level, the shelter beds, right, and getting people off the street. Their overarching mission is, of course, to address the folks who are currently without a stable place to live, right? Some of those folks are living in cars or RVs. Some are couch surfing. Some are currently in shelters or tiny home villages. And some of those folks are living in tents, sleeping in doorways or under bushes, or just wandering to stay warm all night long. Those are the unsheltered folks. There's 23,000 of them in King County, and they're the top priority. So the agency estimates that the county will need to increase their shelter beds by, of course, 23,000 over the next 5 years if more affordable housing is not built. That's the caveat. Now, right now, the city, county, and state are trying to step up and increase the affordable housing stock. So the Regional Homelessness Authority is saying, if the affordable housing stock increases, then it'll make our job a heck of a lot easier, and we'll be able to devote funds not to trying to create more shelter beds, which is kind of a losing proposition when the number of homelessness increases by 50% year over year. But we'll be able to use those funds for providing services for the folks who are chronically homeless because they have a mental illness, they're disabled, they have an addiction or something. We'll be able to get services to those folks, get them stabilized, and get them into permanent housing and out of shelters. So to date, some of the work that the RHA has done includes implementing an emergency housing voucher program that is near full utilization. And this is the short-term stopgap that can get a person off the street, and it works best for those folks who are just recently homeless and have very few barriers to getting back into a permanent home, including the folks who don't have a drug or alcohol addiction, who don't have a mental or physical health issue that prevents them from working and supporting themselves, and they're struggling to survive on tiny disability payments from the federal and state government. And they may already be employed and earning an income, just not enough for them to afford housing in King County. But much of the RHA's work to date has been in coordinating, consolidating programs and trying to streamline the way homeless folks are brought into shelter and get them the services they need. So far, the agency has moved about 4,500 households into housing this year. That's their estimate for this year. But they didn't release a number on how many of those folks stayed housed. They did have numbers on the 2021. So for 2021, they helped 3,699 folks get permanent housing. And they estimate that about 8% of those folks, or about 296 people, have returned to homelessness. That's a 92% success rate, and that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, but the cost per exit is about, to get a person into permanent housing is $29,652 per person. That's the cost of getting them off the street, taking care of them in shelter, and then getting them into a new permanent place to live. and providing them the supports they need to stay there for at least a year, because we don't know long term if that 92% success rate is going to continue. And of course, as expected, the most successful program is the rapid rehousing program, which gets the newly homeless folks with the most resources off the streets quickly. And folks with more complex needs take longer, they cost more to help, they need more services, and they have a lower success rate. So that's worth considering, right? So the overall, the agency's seven goals are, number one, to dramatically reduce unsheltered homelessness, and we've just talked about that. Number two is restructure the service program. We just talked about that, too. But it includes things like providing more capacity, improving the efficiency of the system, providing more supportive services, including a livable wage in King County for service providers who currently make less than half of median income and about half of what it costs to afford a one-bedroom apartment in Seattle. That in itself is an issue when you have folks trying to get people off the street and they themselves can't afford a place to live. That's just not good. That's right.
We saw that recently with Mayor Harrell's proposal to not give an increase to the human service workers.
Well, to give an increase that was only half of inflation, which would have essentially been a pay cut for some of the lowest paid and hardest working people. And some, and we have to start considering them as essential workers, essentially, if we want to address homelessness in King County.
Yeah, and those positions tend to have very high turnover because of the poor pay and the high stress.
They do.
And you know, training new people has a lot of costs, too.
Yes, and as I believe Deborah Wara said when she voted for the full 8% pay increase for service providers in Seattle, she said that a lot of those folks are women and people of color, and we have to support them. And I agree with that. Mm-hmm. Now, the third goal that the RHA has is to deliver accessible, accountable, and responsive services. That, again, is more streamlining, but also focused on the services themselves, not just on the entire system. And that includes streamlining how and when support services are delivered, adding a feature that gives homeless folks the ability to control and access their data when it's entered into the system, and protect their privacy, implementing a real-time resource availability platform so that service providers can see what services, what shelter is available in the moment, making service providers accountable to homeless folks, a very key and important part of the whole program for its success rate, and figuring out how to measure the success of these service programs. So that's a key and very important part of what the RHA is doing and not much talked about. Their fourth goal is to reduce the impact of racism on people experiencing homelessness, because a disproportionately high number of homeless folks are people of color, disabled folks, or LGBTQIA2S+. Okay. That includes addressing things like redlining, housing segregation and discrimination, the provision of accessible housing for the disabled, and addressing the lack of generational wealth building, financial knowledge, and access to resources for BIPOC folks. They also recognize the unique challenges of folks who've been incarcerated. So heavy lift there in that goal. There's a lot included in there, and we're putting all that onto the RHA, right?
Yeah.
So their fifth goal is no family with children sleeps outside. Families make up about 17% of the homeless in King County, even now, after the city and the county have instituted many, many programs to try to help homeless families, right? With the majority of homeless families having very young kids under age 10. And I have to tell you, when you're under age 10, if you're experiencing homelessness, it's going to have a huge impact on the rest of your life. So the RHA recognizes, and the King County Council and the City Council all recognize, that getting families with young kids off the street is a top priority. And then number six on their list is every unaccompanied youth and young adult has a home. About 6.5% of the homeless in King County are unaccompanied youth or young adults. Again, people getting hit at a key part of their life, those key years when you're just graduating, when you're in high school or you're trying to graduate from high school or you're just out of school, you are not, obviously, not going to college. You don't have a job. You may have an addiction or, in the case of many, many young kids on the street, you may, or many, many young adults on the street, you might suffer from some kind of familial trauma or other trauma. You may, have a disability. Those youth really need to be taken care of. You know, they're not in a position where they can take care of themselves. Society has not set them up for success. Their families often have not set them up for success. And so someone needs to come in and give them a hand. And that's also another very heavy lift for the RHA. And then the final of their seven goals is the region acts as one to address homelessness. And this might be the biggest hurdle, right? Since only one of the 39 cities in the county currently contributes to the RHA's budget. That's the city of Seattle, along with King County Council. And many cities have passed laws that add unreasonable barriers to homeless folks trying to get housed. Fortunately,
especially in the suburbs. Yeah.
Fortunately, this month, four cities in North King County just voted to contribute funds in the future to the RHA. That's Bothell, Kenmore, Lake Forest Park, and Shoreline all voted very recently to do that. That's going to start in 2023, and their contributions are going to be small. It's going to total less than $250,000 total, while Seattle gives about $95 million a year. But it's a start. The RHA is trying to get all 39 cities to sign on to helping fund and sign on to the regional implementation plan. And that may be the hardest goal to reach, but it's probably the most important. All of these goals are important, but that one I think is going to be the most important for the continued success of the agency, okay, of the authority. Now, I think it also really exposes the weakness of the social safety net here in the United States when you start looking at the goals and the things, all of the things that the RHA has to do. You know, the lack of affordable housing is just one piece, right? But the lack of affordable and accessible health care, including mental health care and support for disabled folks, is another huge contributor to homelessness and one of the biggest hurdles that many homeless folks face. Income inequality, gentrification and rising rents, the rights of youth in a family, in their families of origin, particularly when they're subjected to abuse. That's another huge one. Those are all huge hurdles that many homeless folks face. Employment discrimination, housing discrimination, stagnating wages and inflation. They're just a lot. So there are many other programs that the city and the county and the state may look at in order to help prevent homelessness. They're currently funding quite a few now, which is good news. But, you know, our society has a lot of ails, and when we talk about homelessness, it's not just only about how unaffordable housing is or about people's addictions, right? Mm-hmm. So just something to keep in mind there. So in their 2023 budget, the Regional Homelessness Authority has a base budget of about $141 million for their ongoing services, but their full budget is $253 million, with that includes $86 million of new funding, and some of that new funding will go to various things, $5 million to purchase 6 to 7 new RV and safe parking lots to increase their capacity from serving 65 vehicles now to 195. $15 million for 12 new daytime community spaces where the homeless can connect to services, which will help get them into shelter and permanent housing. $20 million to purchase up to 345 additional beds of emergency non-congregate shelter, which helps stabilize people faster than congregate shelter does. This would include buying existing family homes, hotels, SROs, or other existing buildings. $20 million for 55 high acuity shelter beds in a high acuity shelter site, with on-site medical and behavioral health to help stabilize the chronically homeless who have high physical and or mental health needs. $1 million for severe weather and emergency response, including heat and smoke shelters, pandemic-related emergencies, and hot and cold weather response, because, you know, currently the RHA only has resources to create about 200 beds, right? And that's not nearly enough. $15.4 million to provide wage increases for their staff and service providers, who, again, are most of whom are making barely above minimum wage, which is about half of what you need to afford a one-bedroom apartment in King County. And then $7.2 million to increase operating funds, and much of that will go to hire more staff, because just like many other businesses and state and county and city agencies, they have a shortage of staff. Okay. And if they're going to implement these new programs, they need more staff. In addition, at the start of 2023, the RHA will redesign and rebid its existing contracts with service providers. And to efficiently review and renew those contracts, the RHA is going to need enough employees to actually do that work and continue to provide the services that they already do. Now, when we look at the specific budget categories, the largest expenses are for enhanced shelter, $71 million, that's shelter with wraparound services. Rapid rehousing, that's $37 million, that's getting people quickly off the street, especially folks who are newly homeless and already have some resources. Housing and essential needs, that's $28 million, that's keeping people housed who are at risk of homelessness. Emergency housing, $20.5 million, that's emergency shelters. Permanent supportive housing, that's $18.5 million, and that's pretty self-explanatory. Now, their operations, or what they pay for administration of the agency, is $18.7 million, or about 7.4% of their total budget. And I have to say, that's a very low figure for any agency, and I think one measure of how efficient they've been. I think the issue when people complain, what's the RHA doing? Why aren't they housing more people? Why aren't they getting more folks off the street? Is they need more money. It's a big job. It's going to require a lot of resources, right? And for what they're spending, they've been doing a pretty good job for the few folks that they've been able to help. But that's got to increase a lot. And the RHA is acknowledging that it can't all come from the city of Seattle and from King County government, which is why they're working pretty hard to get these other suburban cities in King County to contribute.
Saddled them with a lot of stuff to do.
Yeah, they did.
Yep.
It's a big job, but they're clearly working hard to get it.
Yeah, and kick the can down the road, because, you know, while the regional authority has been scaling up, you know, the entire metropolitan area has lost 3 or 4 years of effective response to the homelessness crisis. That was not an accident.
And as Maria pointed out, I mean, so many of these issues are overlapping and contributing to the homelessness, in addition to just lack of housing. And,
yeah, we're kind of asking the RHA to deal on the back end with a problem that society creates in multiple ways, and yeah, funneling people towards failure, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then beating up on the RHA for not solving the multiple problems.
The problem in a year or two. Yeah.
Yeah.
They released their 5-year plan to get unsheltered people out of the cold and rain, right? It's not a 5-year plan to end homelessness by any means.
Or a 10-year plan to end homelessness.
No. I think a much more realistic look at the problem and goal.
Well, luckily, the state of Washington is going to leap into the situation and solve all this, right?
No, but they're trying. Governor Inslee this week
they
released released a proposed 2023 to 2025 budget for Washington State. Excuse me. The Washington State budget runs from the budget for the state of Washington runs from June 2023. The next 2 year period runs from July 1st, 2023 to June 30th, 2025, which is why it looks like I'm talking about 3 years, but it's actually two. The governor said that the big spotlight in his budget proposal is on a new housing initiative that would bring in about $4 billion to build about 5,300 additional affordable housing units during that 22-year period, 2023 to 2025. And then it would build 19,000 units over the following 6 years in Washington State. That would be in addition to the funding that already exists in the state budget to build about 2,200 housing units in the next 2 years. Now, the new initiative would replace some of the federal COVID funding that the state used to build affordable housing in the current 2 year budget that ends in mid-2023. Now, the initiative would lift the state's debt cap to issue bonds. And those bonds that it could issue above the debt cap would be specifically for affordable housing only, not for any other projects. It will have to pass the state legislature, this initiative, and then it would go to the ballot next November for voters to also approve. Inslee cited the state's point in time count of the homeless in Washington State and other state statistics to show that 40% of households in Washington pay more than 35% of their income for rent. So housing in Washington State has become unaffordable to the point that 40% of our residents are not able to easily afford it. Okay.
But the point in time counts themselves haven't been held in like 3 years because of the pandemic.
I don't think that's true. I think there was one just last year. And the median price to buy a home in Washington is increasing by double digits every year. As of 2021, the state had a housing deficit of 81,400 units. And just to keep up with population growth, the state needs to see about 50,000 new units built every year. Okay. Keep that number in mind. 50,000 new units built every year. That's a lot of housing. And of course, the private market isn't coming anywhere near that total. And that's in part because housing construction, real estate developers and landlords are always kind of sensitive about overbuilding because overbuilding can drive down rents and home prices, or even full capacity building can drive down rents and home prices. And that affects the profits of real estate developers and landlords. So it's not a solution for the private market. Okay. Now, the revenue side, to talk a little bit about the state budget and to move away from the housing piece, the revenue side of the state budget had some interesting things to note. The general fund revenues are expected to grow about 3.6%, and that's good news, but also could be a bit of a problem because inflation may outpace that level of growth, depending on whether inflation really is moderating, as some economists say that it is now. That may just be a blip of a month or two. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I know housing costs actually have been going down the last several months in King County.
Mm-hmm. Going down a little bit.
Yeah, which, you know,
which is good news,
it's not a surprise given the bubble that has been, we've been experiencing for the past several years.
Yeah. Also, the real estate excise tax is down because of less private real estate construction. So as you can see, the private market is pretty happy with high prices. But anytime the prices dip a little bit, then construction, boom, stops, right? Sales taxes are up, partially because of inflation. Higher prices for goods and services means that the state can collect more in sales taxes on those higher prices. Okay. The business and occupation tax is up, which shows that the state is recovering from the pandemic and business activity is picking up. Property taxes are also higher, reflecting the increase in property values even during the COVID pandemic. The liter tax on liquor is down after a big spike during the COVID pandemic. But of course, they're high. They're still higher than 2019, so this is probably the level where they should be, right? And the state will be losing about $26 billion in federal COVID-19 funds in the next biennium. All other taxes are mostly up, which means the state budget is stabilizing even without the federal COVID-19 funds. So some good news, a little bit of bad news. So a little bit of mixed there. The state will also have revenue from the capital gains tax, and this is very important, even though there's an ongoing lawsuit against it. Just a couple of weeks ago, the state Supreme Court ruled that the state can collect the tax. The court is going to hear arguments in that lawsuit in January, but in the meantime, it can be considered as a source of revenue for the state budget. If the Supreme Court rules against the capital gains tax, then the state will have to refund that money with interest. But it looks, and I would say it's looking kind of good, that the Supreme Court allowed the tax to go forward and be collected. I think they're leaning towards approving it. In addition, the state will have new revenue from the cap and trade program that the state legislature enacted earlier this year. So that's also really good news for the state budget. And there's a new reserve account that the legislature created last year called the Washington Rescue Plan Transition Account to help with transitioning the state budget after the loss of COVID-19 funds from the federal government. It contains about $2.1 billion that the governor is using to help balance the 2023 to 2025 budget. And then the new budget projects that the state will have about $2.6 billion left over in the state's other reserve accounts if Inslee's budget is enacted as is. So Governor Inslee on the expense side is focusing on three priorities in the new budget. He's saying, you know, we don't have a lot of big holes to fill. We're able to fund most of our services without having to cut anything in order to fill essential services. So let's focus back on three big priorities that we had before the COVID pandemic: housing, homelessness, and behavioral health. That's mental health services. Those are the top three issues. And just like it with the city budget, the state budget has some income sources that are dedicated to specific expenses, and it also has a general fund, which is where the governor and state lawmakers can easily move money around. And I'm just going to look broadly at a couple of categories in the general fund. In the human services portion of the budget, every department is getting an increase, which is really good news. And that includes the healthcare authority, which manages the state health benefit exchange and funding for behavioral health. The Department of Social and Health Services, which got a big increase in the current two-year budget because of COVID-19, would get an additional $6.6 billion. So no decrease, which is also really good news. The Department of Education, which actually doesn't include most funding for K-12 schools, that comes from a separate dedicated funding source, would get a $5.6 billion increase in the general fund. This includes the state's universities and community colleges, the Superintendent of Public Instruction's office, the state schools for the blind and hearing impaired, the Washington State Arts Commission and Historical Societies, and the Workforce Training and Education Board. A subsection of the Department of Education is funding for special ed. That's under the Superintendent of Public Instruction's office, and that will receive a $1.4 billion increase. That's a 58.4% increase for special education in Washington State. That's a long-awaited funding boost and very good news. So, and the budget also contains dedicated funding for salmon habitat restoration and conservation, and funding for clean energy investments with the goal of reaching 100% clean energy by 2045 in Washington State. That includes the transportation budget, which has some funding for electrifying transportation in Washington State. So it all looks like pretty good news. And interestingly, it looks like the state government has a lot of staff not wanting to return to office after working from home for almost 3 years. That's very similar to what a lot of private businesses in Washington state are facing. State agencies are going to be reducing some of their leased office space, which is currently sitting empty. And that's something that may add some additional funds to the state budget for future work and future programs. So some pretty good news when it comes to the state budget. We'll see what the state legislature comes up with, though, because the governor proposes and the state legislature disposes. They'll make changes or they'll have their own versions of a budget that they want to pass.
So we've seen this in recent years where Inslee proposes a budget and then the Democrats who control the state legislature amend it. What are some areas where the legislature has been amending the governor's budget?
A couple of big areas are things like the transportation budget, which usually is its own separate budget bill. The Democrats and Republicans in the state legislature all propose various amendments to the transportation budget to try to get their projects in their districts funded. There was a big transportation bill passed last year. I don't think that they'll be making many changes to it this year, though. Another area that often gets a lot of amendments are education, because there are a lot of advocates for education in the state of Washington that want their projects funded, and there isn't always enough money to fund all of them. Another place where the budget often gets amended is when it comes to dealing with climate change. I'm expecting that there's going to be some discontent with the cap and trade program, and there's going to be some efforts to try to overturn it or amend it or change it to either make it better or to weaken it. So that's another place where people can be looking. And there are going to be some progressive Democrats who are going to want to further and speed up the state's ability to address climate change. So those are other amendments to look out for.
Yeah, my memory is that the legislature frequently weakens the governor's climate change initiatives.
Yeah, and that's something to keep an eye out for. And I'm hoping that won't happen because the Democrats control both the House and the Senate this year. But, you know, there are those Democrats who are very pro-business, and their constituents will have changes that they want to make to things like the cap and trade program.
Yeah. So when did being pro-business equate to doing nothing about climate change? I mean, that makes no sense to me. But.
I know.
It's the,
you would think businesses could be flexible enough to see that as a business opportunity, but there are plenty of businesses that rely on spewing CO2 and other greenhouse gases as a major part of their industry, who don't like any kind of regulations.
Yeah, time to transition to something else.
Yes.
That's supported by the business as usual lobby.
Yes,
yes, exactly.
Exactly.
It was good enough for my granddaddy.
That's right. That's right. It's good enough for you. Okay. Anything else on the budget?
Nope.
All right. Then let's move on to the Respect for Marriage Act.
Yeah. This is our really good news segment of the show. President Biden on Tuesday signed the Respect for Marriage Act into law. That means that the federal government now recognizes same-sex marriages in any state that were consummated in any other state. That is a very, very good news, because you have had a number of red states who were refusing to recognize same-sex marriages in the states where they were performed, which is thanks to the Supreme Court, all of them. So that heads off the threat by the current conservative Supreme Court to revisit legalization of same-sex marriages, which Clarence Thomas had specifically threatened to do after the abortion decision last summer. That's something that Congress needs to do with abortion and with right to privacy and a number of other hot button issues that the conservative Supreme Court would probably like to revisit. You know, Congress is running out of time to do that since the Republicans will control the House and probably impede any efforts in that direction as of next month. So, and time is running out. The Congress goes home for the Christmas holiday at the end of this coming week. So it will be a very eventful week, especially around the January 6th committee, which will be having a public hearing on Monday, and then on Wednesday will release its final report. And that should be very, very interesting. I'm sure we'll be talking about that next week.
Yeah, on Monday they're going to be voting on whether to recommend criminal charges for Donald Trump.
Yes, the committee will be voting on it, yes. Mm-hmm.
All right.
And again, that's just a referral to the Department of Justice. The DOJ has a final word on whether to actually, send
those criminal charges to a
grand jury. Yeah. But reading the tea leaves, the Department of Justice is definitely investigating the former president on a number of different fronts. And it would be pretty surprising if they didn't bring charges on at least one of them. I would think probably the lead candidate in that respect would be, his hoarding of classified materials at Mar-a-Lago, which is a drama that continues. It's inexplicable, and it's something that he has, he's on the face, he's guilty of that, right? Because those documents, should never have left Washington DC, let alone, be held in public places in a country club, 1,000 miles away. So, we'll see what happens next week.
All right.
And then the Republicans will come in, they'll disband the committee, and they will start investigating committee members for treason for digging up evidence against the former president.
All right. Moving on. A couple weeks ago, the railroad workers were about ready to go on strike, and President Biden intervened.
Yes, starting earlier this year, railroad workers' contracts were coming up for renewal, and the White House usually negotiates the replacement contracts, even though these workers work for private companies. These railroad workers are considered essential workers. They're represented by unions. And their working conditions are governed by those union contracts. Well, the White House over the course of the summer negotiated contracts that had a fairly nice pay increase, probably one of the best pay increases that railroad workers have had for a long time, and very welcome to them. On the other hand, however, the White House rejected replacing a points system that had been imposed during the COVID-19 pandemic by the private companies for time off with a paid time off, or paid days off for sick leave, paid sick leave, and paid family leave for railroad workers. Now, it makes sense to me that if you have folks who are essential workers who are working for doing something that is so key to the economy, you want them to have paid sick leave, right? You don't want them coming to work when they're sick and making other people sick.
Yeah, it's not like the pandemic has gone away either.
Right. You don't want them dying on the job and causing major rail accidents or something, or suffering a heart attack on the job.
Especially
right.
When you're running bare bones crews already, a mm-hmm. two-man crew on a friggin' train is not the epitome of safety.
One conductor and one engineer, if you can get that if you can get that compliment on a train, right, isn't necessarily considered the safest, right? So you want things to be running smoothly. You want them to be running safely. But the White House dug in and sided with these private companies saying, oh, no, the point system for hours off is fine, while the workers were saying, no, look, this is a problem, and it's creating problems for us, and it's burning a lot of us out, and we've had people die on the job. Okay, who were not able to take a day off for sick leave or to go see the doctor. That's a problem. The White House said, you know, nope, we're going to stick with private industry. And then Congress can vote to impose a contract on workers, or they can refuse to take that vote and force the White House to negotiate. The railroad workers set a deadline. They said, look, come to the table with a change in the contract or we're going on strike on December 8th. And Congress, instead of stepping back and saying, yeah, negotiate with, you know, the Democrats in Congress, instead of saying, yeah, negotiate with the workers, give them the paid time off that they deserve, that really should be a human right at this point, right? Congress took a vote in the House. They passed a resolution to impose the contract without paid sick leave on railroad workers. That resolution passed 290-137. Here in the state of Washington, all of our representatives, both Democrats and Republicans, voted yes to pass that resolution to force the contract on railroad workers. In the Senate, the vote was 80-15. Both Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray voted yes to pass the resolution.
That's shameful.
It is. Yes, it is. And, you know, when asked to explain, you know, Democratic representatives all said, well, you know, if they strike, that's going to cost the economy $2 billion a day. So my response to that is, okay, well, give them paid sick leave. Right.
Yeah.
You know, make
that,
the
that
companies,
costs a lot less. Yeah.
Make the companies give them real paid sick days. Okay. That's going to cost less over the long term, and it's going to mean a safe workplace. And if they're short of workers, it's going to be an incentive to draw new people in to work those jobs. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Jobs.
Those are good paying jobs. But,
yeah, they are.
But they are also jobs with relatively high turnover because of the working conditions, which are often brutal.
Yeah. And if you don't give people sick leave, you know, to take care of injuries and health issues, then that just doubles down on the turnover. So it was shameful. Yes. But it really shows you the state of the national Democratic Party. I mean, locally you can have progressive Democrats, but once they get up to the national level, they all fall in line behind folks who are fairly conservative, like Joe Biden, and who say that they support workers, but then, you know, don't walk the talk.
And I think particularly Pramila Jayapal locally was a surprise in her willingness to not support railway workers.
If Republican Susan Collins can vote against it, why is Pramila Jayapal voting for that resolution?
Yeah.
Well, moving on, do you want to cover the two international pieces you got, or do we want to talk about Elon Musk and the spiraling disaster at Twitter?
I am so bored with Elon Musk. You know, he reinstated journalists, most journalists, accounts this morning. So, you know, he got another day in the news. I think he's just trolling us, to be honest. But, I wanted to talk about the protests in Peru, which have now killed over 20 people, in the past week. This has to do with the impeachment of the former elected president Pedro Castillo and his replacement with his vice president. Supporters of Castillo have been rioting, particularly in some of the rural areas where Castillo had very strong support. And, you know, the government has been trying to figure out how to respond to that in a way that doesn't involve, you know, police beating people and shooting people, which seems to be, you know, a universal response. So keep an eye on that. And then the other international story that I wanted to underline is the new government in Israel, where Benjamin Netanyahu, our old friend, has taken power once again. But he is also naming ministers this past week. And the ministers that he is putting in charge of things like the Israeli Defense Forces and, excuse me, in the security state, are ultra-right-wing nationalists. That is not good news for any kind of prospects of peace, or any kind of rights for not just Palestinians in the occupied territories, but also Palestinian and Arab citizens of Israel who live in Israel proper. That is still a stratified society. And that's likely to get more extreme, not less extreme, in the coming year. Keep an eye on that tinderbox, because it's going to be messy.
Now, can I jump in for a minute on the Peru story? It can be really easy, you know, here in a country where we have a Congress and a democratic, ostensibly democratic form of government, to side with the Congress in Peru, who wants to overturn Pedro Castillo, wants to vote to remove Pedro Castillo. But I think it's important to remember too that in Peru, the Congress is extremely corrupt. It really represents mostly the wealthy members of society, and that for many, many decades, particularly rural and impoverished folks in Peru have been pretty much disenfranchised. They're huge supporters of Pedro Castillo. I should point out too that five other Latin American countries have come out in support of reinstating Pedro Castillo. That includes Mexico, one of our key allies. So the situation is much more complex than we tend to hear in the United States and in our media. And our mainstream media in particular tends to kind of report these stories superficially, doesn't go back and look at the history of politics in a country, and only sort of reports it with a spin that sort of makes superficial sense to them. They don't really give you the full picture. So
yeah, Castillo is left of center. He's much more populist, and the tension in Peruvian politics, as with many politics in Latin America countries, has been between the ruling elites, who tend to support right wing dictatorships,
and have some pretty brutal and sometimes very racist policies.
Yes. And then the cleavage in that also is between, indigenous communities, which are much more populous in Latin America than they are, in North America, and, tend to be poorer, tend not necessarily be Spanish speaking as their first language. They tend to be the oppressed minorities in those countries. And, we've seen this in Peru, in Ecuador, in Bolivia, in other countries where indigenous leaders have been elected to the highest office, they then tend to get a lot of pushback from the elites. And that's part of what's happening in Peru as well.
All right. Well, that pretty much is all the time we've got for this week.
We always like to end on a down note.
They'll be next week.
Yes. We'll have an item of Christmas cheer for next week, and we'll start looking at the overreported and underhyped stories for 2022 as well.
Underreported and overhyped stories.
Yes.
That too.
That too.
Yes.